Random House Audio presents Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. This is the author, Greg McKeown. Chapter 1. The Essentialist. The wisdom of life consists in the elimination of non-essentials. Lin Yutang. Sam Elliott is a capable executive in Silicon Valley who found himself stretched too thin after his company was acquired by a larger, bureaucratic business. He was in earnest about being a good citizen in his new role, so he said yes to many requests without really thinking about it. But as a result, he would spend the whole day rushing from one meeting and conference call to another, trying to please everyone and get it all done. His stress went up at the same time as the quality of his work went down. It was like he was majoring in minor activities, and as a result, his work became unsatisfying for him and frustrating for the people he was trying so hard to please. In the midst of his frustration, the company came to him and offered him an early retirement package. But he was in his early 50s and had no interest in completely retiring. He thought briefly about starting a consulting company doing what he was already doing. He even thought of selling his services back to his employer as a consultant. But none of these options seemed that appealing. So he went to speak with a mentor who gave him some surprising advice. "Stay," he said, "but do what you would as a consultant and nothing else. And don't tell anyone." In other words, his mentor was advising him to do only those things that he deemed essential and to ignore everything else that was asked of him. The executive followed the advice. He made a daily commitment towards cutting out the red tape. He began saying no. He was tentative at first. He would evaluate requests based on the timid criteria. Can I actually fulfill this request, given the time and resources I have? If the answer was no, then he would refuse the request. He was pleasantly surprised to find that while people would at first look a little disappointed, they seemed to respect his honesty. Encouraged by his small wins, he pushed back a bit more. Now when a request would come in, he would pause and evaluate the request against a tougher criteria. Is this the very most important thing I should be doing with my time and resources right now? If he couldn't answer a definitive yes, then he would refuse the request. And once again, to his delight, while his colleagues might initially seem disappointed, they soon began to respect him more for his refusal and not less. Emboldened, he began to apply this selective criteria to everything, not just direct requests. In his past life, he would always volunteer for presentations or assignments that came up last minute. Now, he found a way to not sign up for them. He used to be one of the first to jump in on an email trail, but now he just stepped back and let others jump in. He stopped attending the conference calls that he only had a couple of minutes of interest in. He stopped sitting in on the weekly update call because he didn't need the information. He stopped attending meetings on his calendar if he didn't have a direct contribution to make. He explained to me, "Just because I was invited didn't seem a good enough reason to attend." It felt self-indulgent at first, but by being selective, he bought himself space. And in that space, he found creative freedom. He could concentrate his efforts on one project at a time. He could plan thoroughly. He could anticipate roadblocks and start to remove obstacles. Instead of spinning his wheels trying to get everything done, he could get the right things done. His newfound commitment to doing only the things that were truly important and eliminating everything else restored the quality of his work. Instead of making just a millimeter of progress in a million directions, he began to generate tremendous momentum towards accomplishing the things that were truly vital. He continued this for several months. He immediately found that he not only got more of his day back at work, in the evenings he got even more time back at home. He said, "I got back my family life. I can go home at a decent time. Now, instead of being a slave to his phone, he shuts it down. He goes to the gym. He goes out to eat with his wife." To his great surprise, there were no negative repercussions to his experiment. His manager didn't chastise him. His colleagues didn't resent him. Quite the opposite. because he was left only with the projects that were meaningful to him and actually valuable to the company. They began to respect and value his work more than ever. His work became fulfilling again. His performance ratings went up, and he ended up with one of the largest bonuses of his entire career. In this example is the basic value proposition of essentialism. Only once you give yourself permission to stop trying to do it all, to stop saying yes to everyone, can you make your highest contribution towards the things that really matter. What about you? How many times have you reacted to a request by saying yes without really thinking about it? How many times have you resented committing to do something and wondered, why did I sign up for this? How often did you say yes simply to please, or to avoid trouble, or because yes had just become your default response? Now let me ask you this. Have you ever found yourself stretched too thin? Have you ever felt both overworked and underutilized? Have you ever found yourself majoring in minor activities? Do you ever feel busy but not productive? Like you're always in motion but never getting anywhere? If you answered yes to any of these, the way out is the way of the essentialist. The way of the essentialist. Dieter Rams was the lead designer at Braun for many years. He is driven by the idea that almost everything is noise. He believes very few things are essential. His job is to filter through that noise until he gets to the essence. For example, as a young 24-year-old at the company, he was asked to collaborate on a record player. The norm at the time was to cover the turntable in a solid wood lid, or even to incorporate the player into a piece of living room furniture. Instead, he and his team removed the clutter and designed a player with a clear plastic cover on the top and nothing more. It was the first time such a design had been used, and it was so revolutionary, people worried it might bankrupt the company because nobody would buy it. It took courage, as it always does, to eliminate the non-essential. By the 60s, this aesthetic started to gain traction. In time, it became the design every other record player followed. Dieter's design criteria can be summarized by a characteristically succinct principle, captured in just three German words, weniger, aber besser. The English translation is less, but better. A more fitting definition of essentialism would be hard to come by. The way of the essentialist is the relentless pursuit of less, but better. It doesn't mean occasionally giving a nod to the principle. It means pursuing it in a disciplined way. The way of the essentialist isn't about setting New Year's resolutions to say no more, or about pruning your inbox, or about mastering some new strategy in time management. It is about pausing constantly to ask, am I investing in the right activities? There are far more activities and opportunities in the world than we have time and resources to invest in. And although many of them may be good or even very good, the fact is that most are trivial and few are vital. The way of the essentialist involves learning to tell the difference, learning to filter through all those options and selecting only those that are truly essential. Essentialism is not about how to get more things done, it's about how to get the right things done. It doesn't mean just doing less for the sake of less either. It is about making the wisest possible investment of your time and energy in order to operate at our highest point of contribution by doing only what is essential. The way of the essentialist rejects the idea that we can fit it all in. Instead, it requires us to grapple with real trade-offs and make tough decisions. In many cases, we can learn to make one-time decisions that make 1,000 future decisions so we don't exhaust ourselves asking the same questions again and again. The way of the essentialist means living by design, not by default. Instead of making choices reactively, the essentialist deliberately distinguishes the vital few from the trivial many, eliminates the non-essentials, and then removes obstacles so the essential things have clear, smooth passage. In other words, essentialism is a disciplined, systematic approach for determining where our highest point of contribution lies, then making execution of those things almost effortless. The way of the essentialist is the path to being in control of our own choices. It is a path to new levels of success and meaning. It is the path on which we enjoy the journey, not just the destination. Despite all these benefits, however, there are too many forces conspiring to keep us from applying the disciplined pursuit of less but better, which may be why so many end up on the misdirected path of the non-essentialist. The way of the non-essentialist. On a bright winter day in California, I visited my wife, Anna, in the hospital. Even in the hospital, Anna was radiant, but I also knew she was exhausted. It was the day after our precious daughter was born, healthy and happy, at 7 pounds, 3 ounces. Yet what should have been one of the happiest, most serene days of my life was actually filled with tension. Even as my beautiful new baby lay in my wife's tired arms, I was on the phone and on email with work, and I was feeling pressure to go to a client meeting. My colleague had written, "Friday between 1 to 2 would be a bad time to have a baby because I need you to come be at this meeting with so-and-so." It was now Friday, and though I was pretty certain, or at least I hoped, the email had been written in jest, I still felt pressure to attend. Instinctively, I knew what to do. It was clearly a time to be there for my wife and newborn child. So when asked whether I planned to attend the meeting, I said with all the conviction I could muster, "Yes." To my shame, while my wife lay in the hospital with our hours-old baby, I went to the meeting. Afterward, my colleague said, "The client will respect you for making the decision to be here." But the look on the client's faces did not evince respect. Instead, they mirrored how I felt. What was I doing there? I had said yes simply to please, and in doing so, I had hurt my family, my integrity, and even the client relationship. As it turned out, exactly nothing came of the client meeting. But even if it had, surely I had made a fool's bargain. In trying to keep everyone happy, I had sacrificed what mattered most. On reflection, I discovered this important lesson. If you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. That experience gave me renewed interest, read inexhaustible obsession, in understanding why otherwise intelligent people make the choices they make in their personal and professional lives. Why is it, I wonder, that we have so much more ability inside of us than we often choose to utilize? And how can we make the choices that allow us to tap into more of the potential inside ourselves and in people everywhere? My mission to shed light on these questions had already led me to quit law school in England and travel, eventually, to California to do my graduate work at Stanford. It had led me to spend more than 2 years collaborating on a book, Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter. And it went on to inspire me to start a strategy and leadership company in Silicon Valley, where I now work with some of the most capable people in some of the most interesting companies in the world, helping to set them on the path of the essentialist. In my work, I have seen people all over the world who are consumed and overwhelmed by the pressures all around them. I have coached successful people in the quiet pain of trying desperately to do everything perfectly now. I have seen people trapped by controlling managers and unaware that they do not have to do all the thankless, busy work they are asked to do. And I have worked tirelessly to understand why so many bright, smart, capable individuals remain snared in the death grip of the non-essential. What I have found has surprised me. I worked with one particularly driven executive who got into technology at a young age and loved it. He was quickly rewarded for his knowledge and passion with more and more opportunities. Eager to build on his success, he continued to read as much as he could and pursue all he could with gusto and enthusiasm. By the time I met him, he was hyperactive, trying to learn it all and do it all. He seemed to find a new obsession every day, sometimes every hour. And in the process, he lost his ability to discern the vital few from the trivial many. Everything was important. As a result, he was stretched thinner and thinner. He was making a millimeter of progress in a million directions. He was overworked and underutilized. I asked him, what would happen if we could figure out the one thing you could do that would make the highest contribution? He responded sincerely, that is the question. As it turns out, many intelligent, ambitious people have perfectly legitimate reasons to have trouble answering this question. One reason is that in our society we are punished for good behavior, for saying no, and rewarded for bad behavior, for saying yes. The former is often awkward in the moment, and the latter is often celebrated in the moment. It leads to what I call the paradox of success, which can be summed up in four predictable phases. Phase 1. When we really have clarity of purpose, it enables us to succeed at our endeavor. Phase 2. When we have success, we gain a reputation as a go-to person. We become good old, insert our name, who is always there when we need him, and we are presented with increased options and opportunities. Phase 3. When we have increased options and opportunities, which is actually code for demands upon our time and energies, it leads to diffused efforts. We get spread thinner and thinner. Phase 4. We become distracted from what would otherwise be our highest level of contribution. The effect of our success has been to undermine the very clarity that led to our success in the first place. Curiously, and overstating the point in order to make it, the pursuit of success can be a catalyst for failure. Put another way, success can distract us from focusing on the essential things that produce success in the first place. We can see this everywhere around us. In his book, How the Mighty Fall, Jim Collins explores what went wrong in companies that were once darlings of Wall Street but later collapsed. He finds that for many, falling into the undisciplined pursuit of more was a key reason for failure. This is true for companies, and it is true for the people who work in them. But why? Why non-essentialism is everywhere? Several trends have combined to create a perfect non-essentialist storm. Consider the following. Too many choices. We have all observed the exponential increase in choices over the last decade. Yet even in the midst of it, and perhaps because of it, we have lost sight of the most important ones. As Peter Drucker said, in a few hundred years, when the history of our time will be written from a long-term perspective, it is likely that the most important event historians will see is not technology, not the internet, not e-commerce. It is an unprecedented change in the human condition. For the first time, literally substantial and rapidly growing numbers of people have choices. For the first time, they will have to manage themselves, and society is totally unprepared for it. We are unprepared in part because, for the first time, the preponderance of choice has overwhelmed our ability to manage it. We have lost our ability to filter what is important and what isn't. Psychologists call this decision fatigue. The more choices we are forced to make, the more the quality of our decisions deteriorates. Too much social pressure. It is not just the number of choices that has increased exponentially, it is also the strength and number of outside influences on our decisions that has increased. While much has been said and written about how hyperconnected we are now, and how distracting this information overload can be, the larger issue is how connectedness has increased the strength of social pressure. Today, technology has lowered the barrier for others to share their opinion about what we should be focusing on. So it's not just information overload, it is opinion overload. The idea that you can have it all. The idea that we can have it all and do it all is not new. This myth has been peddled for so long, I believe virtually everyone alive today is infected with it. It is sold in advertising. It is championed in corporations. It is embedded in job descriptions that provide huge lists of required skills and experience as standard. It is embedded in university applications that require dozens of extracurricular activities. What is new is how especially damaging this myth is today, in a time when choice and expectations have increased exponentially. It results in stressed people trying to cram yet more activities into their already overscheduled lives. It creates corporate environments that talk about work-life balance but still expect their employees to be on their smartphones 24/7, 365. It leads to staff meetings where as many as 10 top priorities are discussed with no sense of irony at all. The word priority came into the English language in the 1400s. It was singular. It meant the very first or prior thing. It stayed singular for the next 500 years. Only in the 1900s did we pluralize the term and start talking about priorities. Illogically, we reasoned that by changing the word, we could bend reality. Somehow we would now be able to have multiple first things. People and companies routinely try to do just that. One leader told me of his experience in a company that talked of Pry 1, Pry 2, Pry 3, Pry 4, and Pry 5. This gave the impression of many things being the priority, but actually meant nothing was. But when we try to do it all and have it all, we find ourselves making trade-offs at the margins that we would never take on as our intentional strategy. When we don't purposefully and deliberately choose where to focus our energies and time, other people, our bosses, our colleagues, our clients, and even our families will choose for us. And before long, we'll have lost sight of everything that is meaningful and important. We can either make our choices deliberately or allow other people's agendas to control our lives. Once an Australian nurse named Bronnie Ware, who cared for people in the last 12 weeks of their lives, recorded their most often discussed regrets. At the top of the list, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. This requires not just haphazardly saying no, but purposefully, deliberately, and strategically eliminating the non-essentials, and not just getting rid of the obvious time wasters, but cutting out some really good opportunities as well. Instead of reacting to the social pressures pulling you to go in a million directions, you will learn a way to reduce, simplify, and focus on what is absolutely essential by eliminating everything else. You can think of this book doing for your life and career what a professional organizer can do for your closet. Think about what happens to your closet when you never organize it. Does it stay neat and tidy with just those few outfits you love to wear hanging on the rack? Of course not. When you make no conscious effort to keep it organized, the closet becomes cluttered and stuffed with clothes you rarely wear. Every so often it gets so out of control you try and purge the closet. But unless you have a disciplined system, you'll either end up with as many clothes as you started with because you can't decide which to give away, end up with regrets because you accidentally gave away clothes you do wear and did want to keep, or end up with a pile of clothes you don't want to keep but never actually get rid of because you're not quite sure where to take them or what to do with them. In the same way that our closets get cluttered as clothes we never wear accumulate, so do our lives get cluttered as well-intended commitments and activities we've said yes to pile up. Most of these efforts didn't come with an expiration date. Unless we have a system for purging them, once adopted, they live on in perpetuity. Here's how an essentialist would approach that closet. 1. Explore and evaluate. Instead of asking, "Is there a chance I will wear this someday in the future?" you ask more disciplined, tough questions. Do I love this? And do I look great in it? And do I wear this often? If the answer is no, then you know it is a candidate for elimination. In your personal or professional life, the equivalent of asking yourself which clothes you love is asking yourself, will this activity or effort make the highest possible contribution toward my goal? Part one of this book will help you figure out what those activities are. 2. Eliminate. Let's say you have your clothes divided into piles of must-keep and probably should get rid of. But are you really ready to stuff the probably should get rid of pile in a bag and send it off? After all, there is still a feeling of sunk cost bias. Studies have found that we tend to value things we already own more highly than they are worth, and thus, that we find them more difficult to get rid of. If you're not quite there, ask the killer question. If I didn't already own this, how much would I spend to buy it? This usually does the trick. In other words, it's not enough to simply determine which activities and efforts don't make the highest possible contribution. You still have to actively eliminate those that do not. Part 2 of this book will show you how to eliminate the non-essentials. And not only that, how to do it in a way that garners you respect from colleagues, bosses, clients, and peers. 3. Execute. If you want your closet to stay tidy, you need a regular routine for organizing it. You need one large bag for items you need to throw away, and a very small pile for items you want to keep. You need to know the drop-off location and hours of your local thrift store. You need to have a scheduled time to go there. In other words, once you've figured out which activities and efforts to keep, the ones that make your highest level of contribution, you need a system to make executing your intentions as effortless as possible. In this book, you'll learn to create a process that makes getting the essential things done as effortless as possible. Of course, our lives aren't static, like the clothes in our closet. Our clothes stay where they are once we leave them in the morning, unless we have teenagers. But in the closet of our lives, new clothes, new demands on our time, are coming at us constantly. Imagine if every time you opened the doors to your closet, you found that people had been shoving their clothes in there. If every day you cleaned it out in the morning and then by the afternoon found it already stuffed to the brim. Unfortunately, most of our lives are much like this. How many times have you started your workday with a schedule and by 10 a.m. you were already completely off track or behind? Or how many times have you written a to-do list in the morning but then found that by 5 p.m. the list was even longer? How many times have you looked forward to a quiet weekend at home with the family, then found that by Saturday morning you were inundated with errands and playdates and unforeseen calamities? But here's the good news. There is a way out. Essentialism is about creating a system for handling the closet of our lives. This is not a process you undertake once a year, once a month, or even once a week, like organizing your closet. It is a discipline you apply each and every time you are faced with a decision about whether to say yes or whether to politely decline. It's a method for making the tough trade-off between lots of good things and a few really great things. It's about learning how to do less but better so you can achieve the highest possible return on every precious moment of your life. This book will show you how to live a life true to yourself, not the life others expect from you. It will teach you a method for being more efficient, productive, and effective in both personal and professional realms. It will teach you a systematic way to discern what is important, eliminate what is not, and make doing the essential as effortless as possible. In short, it will teach you how to apply the disciplined pursuit of less to every area of your life. And here's how. Roadmap. There are 4 parts to the book. The first outlines the core mindset of an essentialist, and the next 3 turn the mindset into a systematic process for the disciplined pursuit of less, one you can use in any situation or endeavor you encounter. A description of each part of the book is below. Essence. What is the core mindset of an essentialist? This part of the book outlines the 3 realities without which essentialist thinking would be neither relevant nor possible. One chapter is devoted to each of these in turn. 1. Individual choice. We can choose how to spend our energy and time. Without choice, there is no point in talking about trade-offs. 2. The prevalence of noise. Almost everything is noise, and a very few things are exceptionally valuable. This is the justification for taking time to figure out what is most important. Because some things are so much more important, the effort in finding those things is worth it. 3. The reality of trade-offs. We can't have it all or do it all. If we could, there would be no reason to evaluate or eliminate options. Once we accept the reality of trade-offs, we stop asking, "How can I make it all work?" and start asking the more honest question, "Which problem do I want to solve?" Only when we understand these realities can we begin to think like an essentialist. Indeed, once we fully accept and understand them, much of the method in the coming sections of the book becomes natural and instinctive. That method consists of the following 3 steps. Step 1, explore. Discerning the trivial many from the vital few. One paradox of essentialism is that essentialists actually explore more options than their non-essentialist counterparts. Whereas non-essentialists commit to everything, or virtually everything, without actually exploring, essentialists systematically explore and evaluate a broad set of options before committing to any. Because they will commit and go big on 1 or 2 ideas or activities, they deliberately explore more options at first to ensure that they pick the right one later. By applying tougher criteria, we can tap into our brain's sophisticated search engine. If we search for a good opportunity, then we will find scores of pages for us to think about and work through. Instead, we can conduct an advanced search and ask 3 questions. What do I feel deeply inspired by? And what am I particularly talented at? And what meets a significant need in the world? Naturally, there won't be as many pages to view, but this is the point of the exercise. We aren't looking for a plethora of good things to do. We are looking for our highest level of contribution, the right thing, in the right way, at the right time. Essentialists spend as much time as possible exploring, listening, debating, questioning, and thinking. But their exploration is not an end in itself. The purpose of the exploration is to discern the vital few from the trivial many. Step 2. Eliminate. Cutting out the trivial many. Many of us say yes to things because we are eager to please and make a difference. Yet the key to making our highest contribution may well be saying no. As Peter Drucker said, people are effective because they say no. Because they say, "This isn't for me." To eliminate non-essentials means saying no to someone, often. It means pushing against social expectations. To do it well takes courage and compassion. So eliminating the non-essentials isn't just about mental discipline. It's about the emotional discipline necessary to say no to social pressure. In this section of the book, we will address this challenging dynamic. Given the reality of trade-offs, we can't choose to do everything. The real question is not how can we do it all, it is who will get to choose what we do and don't do. Remember, when we forfeit our right to choose, someone else will choose for us. So we can either deliberately choose what not to do or allow ourselves to be pulled in directions we don't want to go. This section offers a method for eliminating the non-essentials, thus earning us the time necessary to achieve what is essential. Only then can we build a platform to make execution as effortless as possible, the subject of Step 3. Step 3. Execute. Removing obstacles and making execution effortless. Whether our goal is to complete a project at work, reach the next step in our career, or plan a birthday party for our spouse, we tend to think of the process of execution as something hard and full of friction, something we need to force to make happen. But the essentialist approach is different. Instead of forcing execution, essentialists invest the time they have saved into creating a system for removing obstacles and making execution as easy as possible. These three elements, explore, eliminate, execute, are not separate events as much as a cyclical process. And when we apply them consistently, we're able to reap greater and greater benefits. An idea whose time has come. As a quote attributed to Victor Hugo, the French dramatist and novelist, puts it, "Nothing is more powerful than an idea whose time has come." Less but better is a principle whose time has come. Everything changes when we give ourselves permission to be more selective in what we choose to do. At once we hold the key to unlock the next level of achievement in our lives. There is tremendous freedom in learning that we can eliminate the non-essentials, that we are no longer controlled by other people's agendas, and that we get to choose. With that invincible power, we can discover our highest point of contribution, not just to our lives or careers, but to the world. What if schools eliminated busy work and replaced it with important projects that made a difference to the whole community? What if all students had time to think about their highest contribution to their future so that when they left high school, they were not just starting on the race to nowhere? What if businesses eliminated meaningless meetings and replaced them with space for people to think and work on their most important projects? What if employees pushed back against time-wasting email chains, purposeless projects, and unproductive meetings so they could be utilized at their highest level of contribution to their companies and in their careers? What if society stopped telling us to buy more stuff and instead allowed us to create more space to breathe and think? What if society encouraged us to reject what has been accurately described as doing things we detest to buy things we don't need with money we don't have to impress people we don't like? What if we stopped being oversold the value of having more and being undersold the value of having less? What if we stopped celebrating being busy as a measurement of importance? What if instead we celebrated how much time we had spent listening, pondering, meditating, and enjoying time with the most important people in our lives? What if the whole world shifted from the undisciplined pursuit of more to the disciplined pursuit of less, only better? I have a vision of people everywhere having the courage to live a life true to themselves instead of the life others expect of them. I have a vision of everyone, children, students, mothers, fathers, employees, managers, executives, world leaders, learning to better tap into more of their intelligence, capability, resourcefulness, and initiative to live more meaningful lives. I have a vision of all these people courageously doing what they came here on this earth to do. I have a vision of starting a conversation that becomes a movement. To harness the courage we need to get on the right path, it pays to reflect on how short life really is and what we want to accomplish in the little time we have left. As poet Mary Oliver wrote, "Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" I challenge you to pause more to ask yourself that question. I challenge you here and now to make a commitment to make room to enjoy the essential. Do you think for one second you will regret such a decision? Is it at all likely you will wake up one day and say, "I wish I'd been less true to myself and done all the non-essential things others expected of me"? I challenge you to let me help you create a system that unfairly tips the scales in favor of the essential few over the trivial many. I challenge you to invest in becoming more of an essentialist. This book is not about going back to some simpler time. It's not about eschewing email or disconnecting from the web or living like a hermit. That would be backwards movement. It is about applying the principles of less but better to how we live our lives now and in the future. That is innovation. So my challenge to you is to be wiser than I was on the day of my daughter's birth. I have great confidence in the good that can come from such a decision. Just imagine what would happen to our world if every person on the planet eliminated one good but non-essential activity and replaced it with something truly essential. years from now, hopefully many, when you're at the end of your life, you may still have regrets. But seeking the way of the essentialist is unlikely to be one of them. What would you trade then to be back here now for one chance, this chance, to be true to yourself? On that day, what will you hope you decided to do on this one? If you are ready to look inside yourself for the answer to this question, then you are ready to set out on the path of the essentialist. Let us embark on it together. Essence. What is the core logic of an essentialist? Essentialism is not a way to do one more thing. It is a different way of doing everything. It is a way of thinking. But internalizing this way of thinking is not a neutral challenge. This is because certain ideas, and people peddling those ideas, constantly pull us toward the logic of non-essentialism. There are three chapters in this part of the book. Each takes on a fallacy of non-essentialism and replaces it with a truth of essentialism. There are three deeply entrenched assumptions we must conquer to live the way of the essentialist. I have to, it's all important, and I can do both. Like mythological sirens, these assumptions are as dangerous as they are seductive. They draw us in and drown us in shallow waters. To embrace the essence of essentialism requires we replace these false assumptions with three core truths. I choose to, only a few things really matter, and I can do anything but not everything. These simple truths awaken us from our non-essential stupor. They free us to pursue what really matters. They enable us to live at our highest level of contribution. As we rid ourselves of the nonsense of non-essentialism and replace it with the core logic of essentialism, the way of the essentialist becomes natural and instinctive. Chapter 2. Choose. The invincible power of choice. It is the ability to choose which makes us human. Madeleine L'Engle. I stared, wide-eyed, at the piece of paper in my hands. I was sitting in the foyer of a high-rise office building. It was dusk, and the last few people were trickling out for the evening. The piece of paper, covered with scribbled words and arrows, was the result of a 20-minute spontaneous brainstorm about what I currently wanted to be doing with my life. As I looked at the paper, I was mostly struck by what wasn't on it. Law school was not on the list. This got my attention because I was halfway through my first year at law school in England. I had applied to study law because of repeated advice to keep your options open. Once I got out, I could practice law. I could write about law. I could teach law. I could consult on the law. The world would be my oyster, or so the argument went. Yet from almost the first moment I started studying law, instead of choosing between these pursuits, I had simply tried to fit them all in. I would study my law books at all hours, all day, and read the great management thinkers in the evening. In spare moments, I would write. It was a classic straddled strategy of attempting to invest in everything at once. The result was that while I was not entirely failing in any pursuit, I was not entirely succeeding at any either. I soon began to wonder just what was so great about all these open options. In the middle of all this existential confusion, I received a call from a friend in the United States, inviting me to his wedding. He had already bought and sent the tickets, so I gratefully accepted his invitation and left England for an unexpected adventure. While in the United States, I took every opportunity to meet with teachers and writers. One such meeting was with an executive for a non-profit educational group. As I was leaving his office, he mentioned in passing, "If you decide to stay in America, you should come and join us on a consultation committee." His passing comment had a curious force about it. It wasn't his specific question, it was the assumption he made that I had a choice. If you decide to stay. He saw it as a real option, and this got me thinking. I left his office and took the elevator down to the lobby. I took a single sheet of paper from someone's desk and sat in the lobby and attempted to answer the question, "If you could do only one thing with your life right now, what would you do?" The result was the piece of paper on which law school, as I have indicated, was not written. Up to that point, I had always known logically that I could choose not to study law. But emotionally, it had never been an option. That's when I realized that in sacrificing my power to choose, I had made a choice, a bad one. By refusing to choose not law school, I had chosen law school, not because I actually or actively wanted to be there, but by default. I think that's when I first realized that when we surrender our ability to choose, something or someone else will step in to choose for us. A few weeks later, I officially quit law school. I left England and moved to America to start down the path of becoming an author and a teacher. You're listening to this now because of that choice. Yet for all the impact this specific choice has had on the trajectory of my life, I value the way it changed my view about choices even more. We often think of a choice as a thing, but a choice is not a thing. Our options may be things, but a choice is an action. It is not just something we have, but something we do. And this experience brought me to the liberating realization that while we may not always have control over our options, we always have control over how we choose among them. Have you ever felt stuck because you believed you did not really have a choice? Have you ever felt the stress that comes from simultaneously holding two contradictory beliefs? I can't do this, and I have to do this. Have you ever given up your power to choose bit by bit until you allowed yourself to blindly follow a path prescribed by another person? If so, you are not alone. The invincible power of choosing to choose. For too long, we have overemphasized the external aspect of choices, our options, and underemphasized our internal ability to choose, our actions. This is more than semantics. Think about it this way. Options, things, can be taken away, while our core ability to choose, our free will, cannot be. The ability to choose cannot be taken away or even given away. It can only be forgotten. How do we forget our ability to choose? One important insight into how and why we forget our ability to choose comes out of the classic work of Martin Seligman and Steve Mayer, who stumbled onto what they later called learned helplessness while conducting experiments on German shepherds. Seligman and Mayer divided the dogs into three groups. The dogs in the first group were placed in a harness and administered an electric shock, but were also given a lever they could press to make the shock stop. The dogs in the second group were placed in an identical harness and were given the same lever and the same shock, with one catch. The lever didn't work, rendering the dogs powerless to do anything about the electric shock. The third group of dogs were simply placed in the harness and not given any shocks. Afterwards, each dog was placed in a large box with a load divider across the center. One side of the box produced an electric shock, the other did not. Then something interesting happened. The dogs that either had been able to stop the shock or had not been shocked at all in the earlier part of the experiment quickly learned to step over the divider to the side without shocks. But the dogs that had been powerless in the last part of the experiment did not. These dogs didn't adapt or adjust. They did nothing to try to avoid getting shocked. Why? They didn't know that they had any choice other than to take the shocks. They had learned helplessness. There is evidence that humans learn helplessness in much the same way. One example I heard is that of a child who struggles early on with mathematics. He tries and tries, but never gets any better. So eventually, he gives up. He believes nothing he does will matter. I have observed learned helplessness in many organizations I've worked with. When people believe that their efforts at work don't matter, they tend to respond in one of two ways. Sometimes they check out and stop trying, like the mathematically challenged child. The other response is less obvious at first. They do the opposite. They become hyperactive. They accept every opportunity presented. They throw themselves into every assignment. They tackle every challenge with gusto. They try to do it all. This behavior does not necessarily look like learned helplessness at first glance. After all, isn't working hard evidence of one's belief in one's importance and value? Yet on closer examination, we can see this compulsion to do more is a smokescreen. These people don't believe they have a choice in what opportunity, assignment, or challenge to take on. They believe they have to do it all. I'll be the first to admit that choices are hard. By definition, they involve saying no to something or several somethings, and that can feel like a loss. Outside the workplace, choices can be even harder. Any time we walk into a store or a restaurant or anywhere selling something, everything is designed to make it hard for us to say no. When we listen to a political advertisement or pundit, the objective is to make it unthinkable for us to vote for the other side. When our mother-in-law calls up, mine excluded, of course, and wants us to do something, it can be hardest of all to feel we really have a choice. If we look at everyday life through this lens, it is hardly surprising we forget our ability to choose. Yet choice is at the very core of what it means to be an essentialist. To become an essentialist requires a heightened awareness of our ability to choose. We need to recognize it as an invincible power within us, existing separate and distinct from any other thing, person, or force. William James once wrote, "My first act of free will shall be to believe in free will." That is why the first and most crucial skill you will learn on this journey is to develop your ability to choose choice in every area of your life. When we forget our ability to choose, we learn to be helpless. Drip by drip, we allow our power to be taken away until we end up becoming a function of other people's choices, or even a function of our own past choices. In turn, we surrender our power to choose. That is the path of the non-essentialist. The essentialist doesn't just recognize the power of choice, he celebrates it. The essentialist knows that when we surrender our right to choose, we give others not just the power, but also the explicit permission to choose for us. A non-essentialist thinks, "I have to." An essentialist thinks, "I choose to." A non-essentialist forfeits the right to choose. An essentialist exercises the power of choice. Chapter 3. Discern. The unimportance of practically everything. Most of what exists in the universe, our actions, and all other forces, resources, and ideas, has little value and yields little result. On the other hand, a few things work fantastically well and have tremendous impact. Richard Koch. In George Orwell's classic allegorical novel, Animal Farm, we are introduced to the fictional character Boxer the Horse. He is described as faithful and strong. His answer to every setback and every problem is, "I will work harder." He lives true to his philosophy under the direst circumstances, until, exhausted and broken, he is sent to the knacker's yard. He is a tragic figure. Despite his best intentions, his ever-increasing efforts actually exacerbate the inequality and problems on the farm. Are there ways we can be a bit like Boxer? Do setbacks often only strengthen our resolve to work longer and harder? Do we sometimes respond to every challenge with, "Yes, I can take this on as well"? After all, we have been taught from a young age that hard work is key to producing results, and many of us have been amply rewarded for our productivity and our ability to muscle through every task or challenge the world throws at us. Yet, for capable people who are already working hard, are there limits to the value of hard work? Is there a point at which doing more does not produce more? Is there a point at which doing less, but thinking more, will actually produce better outcomes? I remember when I was young, I wanted to earn some pocket money. One of the few jobs available for 12-year-olds in England was a paper route. It paid about a pound a day and took about an hour. So for a while, I heaved a bag that seemed heavier than I was from door to door for an hour each morning before school. And just for the record, we couldn't just throw the paper onto someone's front porch as is done in the United States. We had to take the paper up to the tiny letterbox on the door and then force the paper all the way through it. It was hard-earned pocket money, to be sure. The considerable effort I had to put in just to earn that £1 a day forever changed the way I thought about the cost of the things I desired. From then on, when I looked at something I wanted to buy, I would translate it into the number of days I would have to deliver the papers to get it. £1 of reward equaled 1 hour of effort. I realized that at this rate it would take quite a while to save up for that micromachine I wanted. Then, as I started to think about how I might speed up the process, I had the insight that I could wash the neighbours' cars on Saturday mornings instead of delivering papers. I could charge £2 per car and could clean 3 in an hour. Suddenly, the ratio of hours to pounds changed from 1 to 1 to 1 to 6. I'd just learned a crucial lesson. Certain types of effort yield higher rewards than others. Years later at university, I went to work at a coaching company. I worked in their customer service department for $9 an hour. It would have been easy to think of the job in terms of that ratio between time and reward, but I knew what really counted was the relationship between time and results. So I asked myself, what is the most valuable result I could achieve in this job? It turned out to be winning back customers who wanted to cancel. So I worked hard at convincing customers not to cancel, and soon I achieved a zero rate of cancellation. Since I was paid for each client I retained, I learned more, earned more, and contributed more. Working hard is important, but more effort does not necessarily yield more results. Less but better does. Ferran Adrià, arguably the world's greatest chef, who has led El Bulli to become the world's most famous restaurant, epitomizes the principle of less but better in at least two ways. First, his specialty is reducing traditional dishes to their absolute essence and then reimagining them in ways people have never thought of before. Second, while El Bulli has somewhere in the range of 2 million requests for dinner reservations each year, it serves only 50 people per night and closes for 6 months of the year. In fact, at the time of writing, Ferran had stopped serving food altogether and had instead turned El Bulli into a full-time food laboratory of sorts where he was continuing to pursue nothing but the essence of his craft. Getting used to the idea of less but better may prove harder than it sounds, especially when we have been rewarded in the past for doing more and more and more. Yet at a certain point, more effort causes our progress to plateau and even stall. It's true that the idea of a direct correlation between results and effort is appealing. It seems fair. Yet research across many fields paints a very different picture. Most people have heard of the Pareto Principle. The idea introduced as far back as the 1790s by Vilfredo Pareto, that 20% of our efforts produce 80% of results. Much later in 1951, in his Quality Control Handbook, Joseph Moses Juran, one of the fathers of the quality movement, expanded on this idea and called it the law of the vital few. His observation was that you could massively improve the quality of a product by resolving a tiny fraction of the problems. He found a willing test audience for this idea in Japan, which at the time had developed a rather poor reputation for producing low-cost, low-quality goods. By adopting a process in which a high percentage of effort and attention was channeled toward improving just those few things that were truly vital, he made the phrase "made in Japan" take on a totally new meaning. And gradually, the quality revolution led to Japan's rise as a global economic power. Distinguishing the trivial many from the vital few can be applied to every kind of human endeavor, large or small, and has been done so persuasively by Richard Koch, author of several books on how to apply the Pareto Principle, the 80-20 rule, to everyday life. Indeed, the examples are everywhere. Think of Warren Buffett, who has famously said, "Our investment philosophy borders on lethargy." What he means is that he and his firm make relatively few investments and keep them for a long time. In The Tao of Warren Buffett, Mary Buffett and David Clark explain, Warren decided early in his career it would be impossible for him to make hundreds of right investment decisions, so he decided that he would invest only in the businesses that he was absolutely sure of, and then bet heavily on them, he owes 90% of his wealth to just 10 investments. Sometimes what you don't do is just as important as what you do. In short, he makes big bets on the essential few investment opportunities and says no to the many merely good ones. Some believe the relationship between efforts and results is even less linear, following what scientists call a power law. According to the power law theory, certain efforts actually produce exponentially better results than others. For example, as Nathan Myhrvold, the former chief technology officer for Microsoft, has said, and then confirmed to me in person, the top software developers are more productive than average software developers not by a factor of 10 times or 100 times or even 1,000 times, but by 10,000 times. It may be an exaggeration, but it still makes the point that certain efforts produce exponentially better results than others. The overwhelming reality is we live in a world where almost everything is worthless and a very few things are exceptionally valuable. As John Maxwell has written, you cannot overestimate the unimportance of practically everything. A non-essentialist thinks almost everything is essential. An essentialist thinks almost everything is non-essential. As we unlearn the one-to-one logic, we begin to see the value in pursuing the way of the essentialist. We discover how even the many good opportunities we pursue are often far less valuable than the few truly great ones. Once we understand this, we start scanning our environment for those vital few and eagerly eliminate the trivial many. Only then can we say no to good opportunities and say yes to truly great ones. This is why an essentialist takes the time to explore all his options. The extra investment is justified because some things are so much more important that they repay the effort invested in finding those things tenfold. An essentialist, in other words, discerns more so he can do less. A non-essentialist thinks almost everything is essential. An essentialist thinks almost everything is non-essential. A non-essentialist views opportunities as basically equal. An essentialist distinguishes the vital few from the trivial many. Many capable people are kept from getting to the next level of contribution because they can't let go of the belief that everything is important. But an essentialist has learned to tell the difference between what is truly important and everything else. To practice this essentialist skill, we can start at a simple level. And once it becomes second nature for everyday decisions, we can begin to apply it to bigger and broader areas of our personal and professional lives. To master it fully will require a massive shift in thinking, but it can be done. Chapter 4. Trade-off. Which problem do I want? Strategy is about making choices, trade-offs. It's about deliberately choosing to be different. Michael Porter. Imagine you could go back to 1972 and invest a dollar in each company in the S&P 500. Which company would provide the largest return on your investment by 2002? Would it be GE, IBM, Intel? According to Money Magazine, and the analysis they initiated from Ned Davis Research, the answer is none of the above. The correct answer is Southwest Airlines. This is startling because the airline industry is notoriously bad at generating profits. Yet Southwest, led by Herb Kelleher, has consistently, year after year, produced amazing financial results. Herb's essentialist approach to business is central to why. I once attended an event where Herb was interviewed about his business strategy. It was a great talk in many ways, but when he began to talk about how deliberate he was about the trade-offs he had made at Southwest, my ears perked up. Rather than trying to fly to every destination, they had deliberately chosen to offer only point-to-point flights. Instead of jacking up prices to cover the cost of meals, he decided they would serve none. Instead of assigning seats in advance, they would let people choose them as they got on the plane. Instead of upselling their passengers on glitzy first-class service, they offered only coach. These trade-offs weren't made by default, but by design. Each and every one was made as part of a deliberate strategy to keep costs down. Did he run the risk of alienating customers who wanted the broader range of destinations, the choice to purchase overpriced meals and so forth? Yes, but Kelleher was totally clear about what the company was, a low-cost airline, and what they were not, and his trade-offs reflected as much. It was an example of his essentialist thinking at work when he said, "You have to look at every opportunity and say, well, no, I'm sorry. We're not going to do 1,000 different things that really won't contribute much to the end result we are trying to achieve." At first, Southwest was lambasted by critics, naysayers, and other non-essentialists who couldn't believe that this approach could possibly be successful. Who in their right mind would want to fly an airline that traveled only to certain places and didn't serve meals, no matter how cheap tickets were? Yet after a few years, it became clear Southwest was onto something. Competitors in the industry took notice of Southwest's soaring profits and started trying to imitate their approach. But instead of adopting Kelleher's essentialist approach, carte blanche, they did what Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter terms straddling their strategy. In the simplest terms, straddling means keeping your existing strategy intact while simultaneously also trying to adopt the strategy of a competitor. One of the most visible attempts at the time was made by Continental Airlines. They called their new point-to-point service Continental Light. Continental Light adopted some of Southwest's practices. They lowered their fares. They got rid of meals. They stopped their first-class service. They increased the frequency of departures. The problem was that because they were still hanging on to their existing business model, Continental Light accounted for only a small percentage of flights offered by the airline, they didn't have the operational efficiencies that would allow them to compete on price. So they were forced to skimp in other ways that ended up compromising the quality of their service. While Southwest had made conscious, deliberate trade-offs in key strategic areas, Continental was forced to sacrifice things around the margins that weren't part of a coherent strategy. According to Porter, a strategic position is not sustainable unless there are trade-offs with other positions. By trying to operate by two incompatible strategies, they started to undermine their ability to be competitive. The straddled strategy was enormously expensive for Continental. They lost hundreds of millions of dollars to delayed planes, and according to Porter, late flights and cancellations generated 1,000 complaints a day. The CEO was eventually fired. The moral of the story: ignoring the reality of trade-offs is a terrible strategy for organizations. It turns out to be a terrible strategy for people as well. Have you ever spent time with someone who is always trying to fit just one more thing in? Such people know that they have 10 minutes to get to a meeting that takes 10 minutes to walk to, but they still sit down to answer a couple of emails before they go. Or they agree to put together a report by Friday, even though they have another huge deadline that same day. Or maybe they promise to swing by their cousin's birthday party on Saturday night, even though they already have tickets to a show that starts at the exact same time. Their logic, which ignores the reality of trade-offs, is, "I can do both." The rather important problem is that this logic is false. Inevitably, they are late to the meeting. They miss one or both of their deadlines, or do a shoddy job on both projects, and they either don't make it to their cousin's celebration or miss the show. The reality is, saying yes to any opportunity by definition requires saying no to several others. Trade-offs are real in both our personal and our professional lives, and until we accept that reality, we'll be doomed to be just like Continental, stuck in a straddled strategy that forces us to make sacrifices on the margins by default that we might not have made by design. In an insightful op-ed for the New York Times, Erin Callan, the former CFO of Lehman Brothers, shared what she had sacrificed in making trade-offs by default. She wrote, "I didn't start out with the goal of devoting all of myself to my job. It crept in over time. Each year that went by, slight modifications became the new normal. First, I spent a half hour on Sunday organizing my email to-do list. and calendar to make Monday morning easier. Then I was working a few hours on Sunday, then all day. My boundaries slipped away until work was all that was left. Her story demonstrates a critical truth. We can either make the hard choices for ourselves or allow others, whether our colleagues, our boss, or our customers, to decide for us. In my work, I've noticed that senior executives of companies are among the worst at accepting the reality of trade-offs. I recently spent some time with the CEO of a company in Silicon Valley valued at $40 billion. He shared with me the value statement of his organization, which he had just crafted and which he planned to announce to the whole company. But when he shared it, I cringed. We value passion, innovation, execution, and leadership. One of several problems with the list is, who doesn't value these things? Another problem is that this tells employees nothing about what the company values most. It says nothing about what choices employees should be making when these values are at odds. This is similarly true when companies claim that their mission is to serve all stakeholders, clients, employees, shareholders, equally. To say they value equally everyone they interact with leaves management with no clear guidance on what to do when faced with trade-offs between the people they serve. Contrast this with how Johnson & Johnson bounced back from the tragic cyanide murder scandal in 1982. At the time, Johnson & Johnson owned 37% of the market and Tylenol was their most profitable product. Then reports surfaced that 7 people had died after taking Tylenol. It was later discovered that these bottles had been tampered with. How should Johnson & Johnson respond? The question was a complicated one. Was their primary responsibility to ensure the safety of their customers by immediately pulling all Tylenol products off drugstore shelves? Was their first priority to do PR damage control to keep shareholders from dumping their stock? Or was it their duty to console and compensate the families of the victims first and foremost? Fortunately for them, they had the Credo, a statement written in 1943 by then-chairman Robert Wood Johnson that is literally carved in stone at Johnson & Johnson headquarters. Unlike most corporate mission statements, the Credo actually lists the constituents of the company in priority order. Customers are first, shareholders are last. As a result, Johnson & Johnson swiftly decided to recall all Tylenol, even though it would have a massive impact, to the tune of $100 million, according to some reports, on their bottom line. The safety of customers or $100 million? Not an easy decision, but the Credo enabled a clearer sense of what was most essential. It enabled the tough trade-off to be made. We can try to avoid the reality of trade-offs, but we can't escape them. I once worked with an executive team that needed help with their prioritization. They were struggling to identify the top 5 projects they wanted their IT department to complete over the next fiscal year, and one of the managers was having a particularly hard time with it. She insisted on naming 18 top priority projects. I insisted that she choose 5. She took her list back to her team, and 2 weeks later they returned with a list she had managed to shorten by 1 single project. I always wondered what it was about that one lone project that didn't make the cut. By refusing to make trade-offs, she ended up spreading 5 projects worth of time and effort across 17 projects. Unsurprisingly, she did not get the results she wanted. Her logic had been, we can do it all. Obviously not. It is easy to see why it's so tempting to deny the reality of trade-offs. After all, by definition, a trade-off involves 2 things we want. Do you want more pay or more vacation time? Do you want to finish this next email or be on time to your meeting? Do you want it done faster or better? Obviously, when faced with the choice between 2 things we want, the preferred answer is yes to both. But as much as we'd like to, we simply cannot have it all. A non-essentialist approaches every trade-off by asking, how can I do both? Essentialists ask the tougher but ultimately more liberating question, which problem do I want? an essentialist makes trade-offs deliberately. She acts for herself rather than waiting to be acted upon. As economist Thomas Sowell wrote, "There are no solutions, there are only trade-offs."